of Mr. and Mrs. Owens and of the other family, the one he could not remember, when there was a knock on the door. The class and Mr. Kirby all looked to see who was there. It was a year seven who had been sent to borrow a textbook. And as they turned, Bod felt something stab in the back of his hand. He did not cry out. He just looked up. Nick Farthing grinned down at him, a sharpened pencil in his fist.
"I'm not afraid of you."
Bod looked at the back of his hand. A small drop of blood welled up where the point of the pencil had punctured it. Mo Quilling passed Bod in the corridor that afternoon, her eyes so wide he could see the whites all around them.
"You're weird. You don't have any friends."
"I didn't come here for friends. I came here to learn."
Mo's nose twitched.
"Do you know how weird that is? Nobody comes to school to learn. I mean, you come because you have to."
Bod shrugged.
"I'm not afraid of you. Whatever trick you did yesterday, you didn't scare me."
"Okay."
And he walked on down the corridor. He wondered if he had made a mistake, getting involved. He had made a misstep in judgment. That was for certain. Mo and Nick had begun to talk about him. Probably the year sevens had as well. Other kids were looking at him, pointing him out to each other. He was becoming a presence rather than an absence, and that made him uncomfortable. Silas had warned him to keep a low profile, told him to go through school partly faded, but everything was changing. He talked to his guardian that evening, told him the whole story. He was not expecting Silas's reaction.
"I cannot believe that you could have been so stupid. Everything I told you about remaining just this side of invisibility. And now you've become the talk of the school."
"Well, what did you want me to do?"
"Not this. It's not like the olden times. They can keep track of you, Bart. They can find you."
Silas's unmoving exterior was like the hard crust of rock over molten lava. Bod knew how angry Silas was, only because he knew Silas. He seemed to be fighting his anger, controlling it. Bod swallowed.
"What should I do?"
"Don't go back. This school business was an experiment. Let us simply acknowledge that it was not a successful one."
Bod said nothing. Then he said,
"It's not just the learning stuff. It's the other stuff. Do you know how nice it is to be in a room filled with people and for all of them to be breathing?"
"It's not something in which I've ever taken pleasure. So, you don't go back to school tomorrow?"
"I'm not running away. Not from Mo or Nick or school. I'd leave here first."
"You will do as you are told, boy,"
said Silas. A knock of velvet anger in the darkness.
"Or what?"
said Bod, his cheeks burning.
"What would you do to keep me here? Kill me?"
And he turned on his heel and began to walk down the path that led to the gates and out of the graveyard. Silas began to call the boy back. Then he stopped and stood there in the night alone. At the best of times, his face was unreadable. Now his face was a book, written in a language long forgotten, in an alphabet unimagined. Silas wrapped the shadows around him like a blanket and stared after the way the boy had gone and did not move to follow. Nick Farthing was in his bed, asleep, and dreaming of pirates on the sunny blue sea, when it all went wrong. One moment he was the captain of his own pirate ship, a happy place, crewed by obedient 11-year-olds, except for the girls, who were all a year or two older than Nick and who looked especially pretty in their pirate costumes. And the next, he was alone on the deck, and a huge, dark ship the size of an oil tanker, with ragged black sails and a skull for the figurehead, was crashing through the storm towards him. And then, in the way of dreams, he was standing on the black deck of the new ship, and someone was looking down at him.
"You're not afraid of me,"
said the man standing over him. Nick looked up. He was scared, in his dream, scared of this dead-faced man in pirate costume, his hand on the hilt of a cutlass.
"Do you think you're a pirate, Nick?"
asked his captor. And suddenly, something about him seemed familiar to Nick.
"You're that kid, Bob Owens."
"I am nobody, and you need to change. Turn over a new leaf, reform, all that, or things will get very bad for you."
"Bad how?"
"Bad in your head,"
said the pirate king, who was now only the boy from his class, and they were in the school hall, not the deck of the pirate ship, although the storm had not abated, and the floor of the hall pitched and rolled like a ship at sea.
"This is a dream."
"Of course it's a dream. I would have to be some kind of monster to do this in real life."
"What can you do to me in a dream?"
He smiled.
"I'm not afraid of you. You've still got my pencil in the back of your hand."
He pointed to the back of Bod's hand, at the black mark the graphite point had made.
"I was hoping it wouldn't have to be like this."
He tipped his head on one side as if he was listening to something.
"They're hungry."
"What are?"
"The things in the cellar. Or below decks. Depends whether this is a school or a ship, doesn't it?"
Nick felt himself beginning to panic.
"It isn't spiders, is it?"
"It might be. You'll find out, won't you?"
Nick shook his head.
"No. Please, no."
"Well, it's all up to you, isn't it? Change your ways, or visit the cellar."
The noise got louder, a scuttling, sort of a scuffling noise, and while Nick Farthing had no idea what it was, he was utterly, completely certain that whatever it would turn out to be the most scary, terrible thing he had ever, would ever encounter. He woke up, screaming. Bod heard the scream, a shout of terror, and felt the satisfaction of a job well done. He was standing on the pavement outside Nick Farthing's house, his face damp from the thick night mist. He was exhilarated and exhausted. He had felt barely in control of the dream walk. Had been all too aware that there was nothing else in the dream but Nick and himself, and that all Nick had been scared of was a noise. But Bod was satisfied. The other boy would hesitate before tormenting smaller kids. And now? Bod put his hands in his pockets and began to walk, not certain where he was going. He would leave the school, he thought. Just as he had left the graveyard, he would go somewhere no one knew him, and he would sit in a library all day and read books and listen to people breathing. He wondered if there were still deserted islands in the world, like the one on which Robinson Crusoe had been shipwrecked. He could go and live on one of those. Bod did not look up. If he had, he would have seen a pair of watery blue eyes watching him intently from a bedroom window. He stepped into an alley, feeling more comfortable out of the light.
"Are you running away, then?"
Bod said nothing.
"That's the difference between the living and the dead, isn't it?"
It was Liza Hemstock talking. Bod knew, although the witch girl was nowhere to be seen.
The dead don't disappoint you. They've had their life, done what they've done. We don't change. The living, they always disappoint you, don't they? You meet a boy who's all brave and noble, and he grows up to run away.
That's not fair.
The nobody Owens I knew wouldn't have run off from the graveyard without saying so much as a fare thee well to those who cared for him. You'll break Mistress Owen's heart.
Bard had not thought of that.
I had a fight with Silas.
So?
He wants me to come back to the graveyard. To stop school. He thinks it's too dangerous.
Why? Between your talents and my bespellment, they'll barely notice you.
I was getting involved. There were these kids bullying other kids. I wanted them to stop. I drew attention to myself.
Liza could be seen now. A misty shape in the alleyway, keeping pace with Bod.
He's out here somewhere, and he wants you dead. Him has killed your family. Us in the graveyard, we wants you to stay alive. We wants you to surprise us, and disappoint us, and impress us, and amaze us. Come home, Bard.
I think... I said things to Silas. He'll be angry.
If he didn't care about you, you couldn't upset him.
The fallen autumn leaves were slick beneath Bard's feet, and the mists blurred the edges of the world. Nothing was as clean-cut as he had thought it a few minutes before.
I did a dream walk.
How did it go?
Good. Well, all right.
You should tell Mr. Pennyworth. He'll be pleased.
You're right, I should.
He reached the end of the alley, and instead of turning right, as he had planned, and off into the world, he turned left, onto the High Street, the road that would take him back to Dunstan Road and the graveyard on the hill.
What? What you doing?
Going home, like you said.
There were shop lights now. Bod could smell the hot grease from the chip shop on the corner. The paving stones glistened.
That's good,
said Liza Hemstock, now only a voice once more. Then the voice said,
run, or fade, something's wrong.
Bod was about to tell her that there was nothing wrong, that she was being foolish, when a large car with a light flashing on the top came veering across the road and pulled up in front of him. Two men got out from it.
Excuse me, young man. Police, may I ask what you're doing out so late?
I didn't know there was a law against it.
The largest of the policemen opened the rear door of the car.
Is this the young man you saw, miss?
Mo Quilling got out of the car and looked at Bod and smiled.
That's him. He was in our back garden breaking things, and then he ran away.
She looked Bod in the eye.
I saw you from my bedroom. I think he's the one who's been breaking windows.
What's your name?
Asked the smaller policeman. He had a ginger moustache.
Nobody. Ow!
The ginger policeman had taken Bod's ear between finger and thumb and had given it a hard squeeze.
Don't give me that. Just answer the questions politely, right?
Bod said nothing.
Where exactly do you live?
Bod said nothing. He tried to fade, but fading, even when boosted by a witch, relies on people's attention sliding away from you. And everybody's attention, not to mention a large pair of official hands, was on him then.
You can't arrest me for not telling you my name or address.
No, I can't, but I can take you down to the station until you give us the name of a parent, guardian, responsible adult into whose care we can release you.
He put Bod into the back of the car where Mo Quilling sat, with a smile on her face of a cat who has eaten all the canaries.
I saw you from my front window, so I called the police.
I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't even in your garden. And why are they bringing you out to find me?
Quiet back there.
Everyone was quiet until the car pulled up in front of a house that had to be Mo's. The large policeman opened the door for her, and she got out.
We'll call you tomorrow. Let your mum and dad know what we found.
Thanks, Uncle Tam.
And she smiled.
Just doing my duty.
They drove back through the town in silence, Bod trying to fade as best he could, with no success. He felt sick and miserable. In one evening, he had had his first real argument with Silas, had attempted to run away from home, had failed to run away, and now failed to return home. He could not tell the police where he lived, or his name. He would spend the rest of his life in a police cell, or in a prison for kids.
Did they have prison for kids?
He didn't know.
Excuse me, do they have prisons for kids?
Getting worried now, are you? I don't blame you. You kids, running wild. Some of you need locking up, I'll tell you.
Bod wasn't sure if that was a yes or a no. He glanced out of the car window. Something huge was flying through the air. Above the car and to one side, something darker and bigger than the biggest bird, something man-sized, that flickered and fluttered as it moved, like the strobing flight of a bat.
When we get to the station, best if you just give us your name. Tell us who to call to come and get you. We can tell them we gave you a bollocking. They can take you home, see? You cooperate, we have an easy night. Less paperwork for everyone. We're your friends.
You're too easy on him. A night in the cells isn't that hard.
Then he looked back at Bod.
Unless it's a busy night and we have to put you in with some of the drunks, they can be nasty.
Bod thought.
He's lying. They're doing this on purpose. The friendly one and the tough one.
Then the police car turned a corner and there was a thump. Something big rode up onto the hood of the car and was knocked off into the dark. A screech of brakes as the car stopped and the ginger policeman began to swear under his breath.
He just ran out into the road. You saw it.
I'm not sure what I saw. You hit something, though.
They got out of the car, shone lights around.
He was wearing black. You can't see it.
He's over here.
The two men hurried over to the body on the ground, holding flashlights. Bod tried the door handles on the back seat. They did not work. And there was a metal grill between the back and the front. Even if he faded, he was still stuck in the back seat of a police car. He leaned over as far as he could, craning to try and see what had happened, what was on the road. The ginger policeman was crouched beside a body, looking at it. The other, the large one, was standing above it, shining a light down into its face. Bod looked at the face of the fallen body. Then he began to bang on the window, frantically, desperately. The large policeman came over to the car.
What?
You hit my dad.
You're kidding.
It looks like him. Can I look properly?
The large policeman's shoulders slumped.
Oi, Simon, the kid says it's his dad.
You've got to be bloody kidding me.
I think he's serious.
The large policeman opened the door and Bod got out. Silas was sprawled on his back on the ground where the car had knocked him. He was deathly still. Bod's eyes prickled.
Dad? You killed him.
He wasn't lying, he told himself. Not really.
I've called an ambulance.
It was an accident, said the other.
Bod crouched by Silas, and he squeezed Silas's cold hand in his. If they had already called an ambulance, there was not much time.
So that's your career's over, then?
It was an accident. You saw?
He just stepped out.
What I saw is that you agreed to do a favour for your niece and frighten a kid she's been fighting with at school. So you arrested me without a warrant for being out late. And then, when my dad runs out into the road to try and stop you or to find out what was going on, you intentionally ran him over.
It was an accident.
You've been fighting with Mo at school.
We're both in 8B at the Old Town School. And you killed my dad.
Far off, he could hear the sound of sirens.
Simon, we have to talk about this.
They walked over to the other side of the car, leaving Bod alone in the shadows with the fallen Silas. Bod could hear the two policemen talking heatedly.
Your bloody niece!
If you'd kept your eyes on the road...
Simon jabbed his finger into Tam's chest.
They aren't looking. Now!
And he faded. There was a swirl of deeper darkness, and the body on the ground was now standing beside him.
I'll take you home. Put your arms around my neck.
Bod did, holding tightly to his guardian, and they plunged through the night, heading for the graveyard.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry too.
Did it hurt? Letting the car hit you like that?
Yes. You should thank your little witch friend. She came and found me, told me you were in trouble, and what kind of trouble you were in.
They landed in the graveyard. Bod looked at his home as if it was the first time he had ever seen it.
What happened tonight was stupid, wasn't it? I mean, I put things at risk.
More things than you know, young Nobody Owens. Yes.
You were right. I won't go back. Not to that school. And not like that.
Maureen Quilling had had the worst week of her life. Nick Farthing was no longer speaking to her. Her uncle, Tam, had shouted at her about the Owens kid thing. Ben told her not to mention anything about that evening, ever, to anyone, as he could lose his job, and he wouldn't want to be in her shoes if that happened. Her parents were furious with her. She felt betrayed by the world. Even the Year Sevens weren't scared of her any longer. It was rotten. She wanted to see that Owens kid, who she blamed for everything that had happened to her so far, writhing in miserable agony. If he thought being arrested was bad... And then she would concoct elaborate revenge schemes in her head, complex and vicious. They were the only thing that made her feel better. And even they didn't really help. If there was one job that gave Mo the creeps, it was cleaning up the science labs, putting away the Bunsen burners, making sure that all test tubes, petri dishes, unused filter papers and the like were returned to their places. She only had to do it on a strict rotation system once every 2 months, but it stood to reason that here, in the worst week of her life, she would be in the science lab. At least Mrs. Hawkins, who taught general sciences, was there, collecting papers, gathering things up at the end of the day. Having her there, having anybody there, was comforting.
You're doing a good job, Maureen.
A white snake in a jar of preservative stared blindly down at them.
Thanks.
Aren't there meant to be two of you?
I was supposed to be doing it with the Owens kid, but he hasn't been to school in days now.
The teacher frowned.
Which one was he? I don't have him down on my list.
Bob Owens? Brownish hair? A bit too long. Didn't talk much. He was the one who named all the bones of the skeleton in the quiz. Remember?
Not really.
You must remember. Oh, nobody remembers him. Not even Mr. Kirby.
Mrs. Hawkins pushed the rest of the sheets of paper into her bag.
Well, I appreciate you doing it on your own, dear. Don't forget to wipe down the working surfaces before you go.
And she went, closing the door behind her. The science labs were old, There were long, dark wooden tables with gas jets and taps and sinks built into them, and there were dark wooden shelves upon which were displayed a selection of things in large bottles. The things that floated in the bottles were dead, had been dead for a long time. There was even a yellowed human skeleton in one corner of the room. Mo did not know if it was real or not, but right now it was creeping her out. Every noise she made echoed in that long room. She turned all of the overhead lights on, even the light on the whiteboard, just to make the place less scary. The room began to feel cold. She wished she could turn up the heat. She walked over to one of the large metal radiators and touched it. It was burning hot. But still, she was shivering. The room was empty and unsettling in its emptiness, and Mo felt as if she were not alone, as if she was being watched.
Well, of course I'm being watched. 100 dead things in jars are all looking at me. Not to mention the skeleton.
She glanced up at the shelves. That was when the dead things in the jars began to move. A snake with unseeing milky eyes uncoiled in its alcohol-filled jar. A faceless, spiny sea creature twisted and revolved in its liquid home. A kitten, dead for decades, showed its teeth and clawed the glass. Mo closed her eyes.
This isn't happening. I'm imagining it. I'm not frightened.
That's good,
said someone, standing in the shadows by the rear door.
It seriously sucks to be frightened.
None of the teachers even remember you.
But you remember me,
said the boy, the architect of all her misfortunes. She picked up a glass beaker and threw it at him, but her aim went wide, and it smashed against a wall.
How's Nick?
Asked Bod, as if nothing had happened.
You know how he is. He won't even talk to me. Just shuts up in class, goes home and does his own work. Probably building model railways.
Good.
And you? You haven't been at school for a week. You're in such trouble, Bob Owens. The police came in the other day. They were looking for you.
That reminds me. How's your Uncle Tam?
Mo said nothing.
In some ways, you've won. I'm leaving school. And in other ways, you haven't. Have you ever been haunted, Maureen Quilling? Ever looked in the mirror, wondering if the eyes looking back at you were yours? Ever sat in an empty room and realized you were not alone? It's not pleasant.
You're going to haunt me?
Bod said nothing at all. He just stared at her. In the far corner of the room, something crashed. Her bag had slipped off the chair onto the floor, and when she looked back, she was alone in the room. Or, at least, there was nobody that she could see in there with her. Her way home was going to be very long and very dark. The boy and his guardian stood at the top of the hill, looking out at the lights of the town.
Does it still hurt?
A little. But I heal fast. I'll soon be as good as ever.
Could it have killed you, stepping out in front of that car?
His guardian shook his head.
There are ways to kill people like me, but they don't involve cars. I am very old and very tough.
I was wrong, wasn't I? The whole idea was to do it without anybody noticing. And then I had to get involved with the kids in the school. And the next thing you know, there's police and all sorts of stuff. Because I was selfish.
Silas raised an eyebrow.
You weren't selfish. You need to be among your own kind. Quite understandable. It's just harder out there in the world of the living, and we cannot protect you out there as easily. I wanted to keep you perfectly safe. But there is only one perfectly safe place for your kind, and you will not reach it until all your adventures are over, and none of them matter any longer.
Bod rubbed his hand over the stone of Thomas R. Stout, 1817 to 1851, deeply regretted by all who knew him, feeling the moss crumble beneath his fingers.
He's still out there. The man who killed my first family. I still need to learn about people. Are you going to stop me leaving the graveyard?
No. That was a mistake, and one that we have both learned from.
Then what?
We should do our best to satisfy your interest in stories and books and the world. There are libraries. There are other ways. And there are many situations in which there might be other living people around you. Like the theatre or the cinema.
What's that? Is it like football? I enjoyed watching them play football at school.
Football? That's usually a little early in the day for me. But Miss Lupescu could take you to see a football match the next time she's here.
I'd like that.
They began to walk down the hill.
We have both left too many tracks and traces in the last few weeks. They are still looking for you, you know.
You said that before. How do you know? And who are they? And what do they want?
But Silas only shook his head and would be drawn no further. And with that, for the time being, Bod had to be satisfied. Chapter 7. Every Man Jack. Silas had been preoccupied for the previous several months. He had begun to leave the graveyard for days, sometimes weeks at a time. Over Christmas, Miss Lupescu had come out for 3 weeks in his place, and Bod had shared her meals in her little flat in the old town. She had even taken him to a football match, as Silas had promised that she would, but she had gone back to the place she called the old country, after squeezing Bod's cheeks and calling him Nimini, which had become her pet name for him. Now Silas was gone, and Miss Lupescu also. Mr. and Mrs. Owens were sitting in Josiah Worthington's tomb, talking to Josiah Worthington. None of them was happy.
You mean to say that he did not tell either of you where he was going, or how the child was to be cared for?
When the Owenses shook their heads.
Well, where is he?
Neither Owens was able to answer.
He's never been gone for so long before. And he promised, when the child came to us, promised he would be here, or someone else would be here to help us care for him. He promised.
I worry that something must have happened to him.
She seemed close to tears, and then her tears turned to anger.
This is too bad of him. Is there no way to find him, to call him back?
None that I know, but I believe that he's left money in the crypt for food for the boy.
Money? What use is money?
Bod will be needing money if he's to go out there to buy food,
began Mr. Owens. But Mrs. Owens turned on him.
You're all as bad as each other.
She left the Worthington tomb then, and she went looking for her son, whom she found, as she expected to, at the top of the hill, staring out over the town.
Penny for your thoughts?
You don't have a penny.
He was 14 now, and taller than his mother.
I've got two in the coffin. Probably a bit green by now, but I've still got them right enough.
I was thinking about the world. How do we even know that the person who killed my family is still alive? That he's out there?
Silas says he is.
But Silas doesn't tell us anything else.
He means only the best for you. You know that.
Thanks. So where is he?
Mrs. Owens made no reply.
You saw the man who killed my family, didn't you? On the day you adopted me.
Mrs. Owens nodded.
What was he like?
Mostly I had eyes for you. Let me see. He had dark hair, very dark, and I was frightened of him. He had a sharp face, hungry and angry all at once he was. Silas saw him off.
Why didn't Silas just kill him? He should have just killed him then.
Mrs. Owens touched the back of Bod's hand with her cold fingers.
He's not a monster, Bod.
If Silas had killed him back then, I would be safe now. I could go anywhere.
Silas knows more than you do about all this, more than any of us do. And Silas knows about life and death. It's not that easy.
What was his name? The man who killed them?
He didn't say it. Not then.
Bod put his head on one side and stared at her with eyes as grey as thunderclouds.
But you know it, don't you?
There's nothing you can do, Bod.
There is. I can learn. I can learn everything I need to know, all I can. I learned about ghoul gates. I learned to dreamwalk. Miss Lupescu taught me how to watch the stars. Silas taught me silence. I can haunt. I can fade. I know every inch of this graveyard.
Mrs. Owens reached out a hand, touched her son's shoulder.
One day,
she hesitated. One day, she would not be able to touch him. One day, he would leave them. One day.
Silas told me the man who killed your family was called Jack.
Bod said nothing. Then he nodded.
Mother?
What is it, son?
When will Silas come back?
The midnight wind was cold, and it came from the north. Mrs. Owens was no longer angry. She feared for her son.
I wish I knew, my darling boy. I wish I knew.
Scarlett Amber Perkins was 15, and at that moment, sitting on the upper deck of the elderly bus, she was a mass of angry hate. She hated her parents for splitting up. She hated her mother for moving away from Scotland. Hated her father because he didn't seem to care that she had gone. She hated this town for being so different. Nothing like Glasgow, where she had grown up. And she hated it because every now and again she would turn a corner and see something, and the world would all become achingly, horribly familiar. She had lost it with her mother that morning.
At least in Glasgow I had friends,
Scarlett had said, and she wasn't quite shouting, and she wasn't quite sobbing.
I'll never see them again.
All her mother had said in reply was,
at least you're somewhere you've been before. I mean, we lived here when you were little.
I don't remember. And it's not like I still know anyone. Do you want me to find my old friends from when I was 5? Is that what you want?
Well, I'm not stopping you.
Scarlet had gone through the whole of the school day angry, and she was angry now. She hated her school, and she hated the world, and right now she particularly hated the town bus service. Every day, when school was over, the 97 bus to the city centre would take her from her school gates all the way to the end of the street, where her mother had rented a small flat. She had waited at the bus stop on that gusty April day for almost half an hour, and no 97 buses had appeared. So, when she saw a 121 bus, with city centre as its destination, she had climbed aboard. But where her bus always turned right, this one turned left, into the old town, past the municipal gardens in the old town square, past the statue of Josiah Worthington, baronet, and then crept up a winding hill lined with high houses as Scarlet's heart sank and her anger was replaced with misery. She walked downstairs, edged forward, eyed the sign telling her not to speak to the driver when the vehicle was in motion, and said,
"Excuse me, I want to go to Acacia Avenue."
The driver, a large woman, her skin even darker than Scarlet's, said,
"You should have got the 97 then."
"But this goes to the city centre."
"Eventually. But even when you get there, you'll still need to get back. Best thing you can do? Get off here, walk back down the hill. There's a bus stop in front of the town hall. From there, you can catch the number 4 or the 58. Both of them will take you most of the way to Acacia Avenue. You could get off by the sports centre and walk up from there. You got all that?"
"The 4 or the 58.
"I'll let you off here."
It was a request stop on the side of the hill, just past a large pair of open iron gates. And it looked uninviting and dismal. Scarlet stood in the open doorway of the bus until the bus driver said,
"Go on, hop it."
She stepped down onto the pavement, and the bus belched black smoke and roared away. The wind rattled the trees on the other side of the wall. Scarlet began to walk back down the hill. This was why she needed a mobile phone, she thought. If she was so much as 5 minutes late, her mother would freak. But she still wouldn't buy Scarlet a phone of her own. Oh, well, she would have to endure another shouting match. It wouldn't be the first, and it wouldn't be the last. By now, she was level with the open gates. She glanced inside, and...
"That's odd."
There's an expression, déjà vu, that means that you feel like you've been somewhere before, that you've somehow already dreamed it or experienced it in your mind. Scarlet had experienced it. The knowledge that a teacher was just about to tell them that she'd been to Inverness on holiday, or that someone had dropped a spoon in just that way before. This was different. This wasn't a feeling that she had been here before. This was the real thing. Scarlet walked through the open gates into the graveyard. A magpie flew up as she walked in, a flash of black and white and iridescent green, and settled in the branches of a yew tree, watching her.
"Around that corner is a church with a bench in front of it."
And she turned a corner to see a church, much smaller than the one in her head, a sinister, blocky little Gothic building of grey stone with a jutting spire. In front of it was a weathered wooden bench. She walked over, sat down on the bench, and swung her legs as if she was still a little girl.
"Hello? Hello?"
said a voice from behind her.
"Awful cheek of me, I know, but would you help me hold down this... just really need another pair of hands, if it's not too much trouble."
Scarlet looked around, and saw a man in a fawn-coloured raincoat squatting in front of a gravestone. He was holding a large sheet of paper which was blowing about in the wind. She hurried over to him.
You hold on to it here. One hand here. One hand there. That's it. Frightful imposition, I know. Ridiculously grateful.
He had a biscuit tin next to him, and from the tin he pulled what looked like a crayon, the size of a small candle. He began rubbing it back and forth across the stone with easy practice movements.
There we go. And here she comes. Whoops! A wiggly bit down at the bottom here. I think it's meant to be ivy. The Victorians loved putting ivy on things. Deeply symbolic, you know. And there we are. You can let go now.
He stood up, ran one hand through his grey hair.
Ah! Needed to stand. Legs got a bit pins and needlesy. So, what do you reckon to that?
The actual headstone was covered in green and yellow lichen, and so worn and faded as to almost be undecipherable. But the rubbing was clear.
Magilla Godspeed, spinster of this parish, 1791 to 1870. Lost to all but memory.
And probably now lost even to that.
His hair was thinning, and he smiled hesitantly and blinked at her through small round glasses, which made him look a little like a friendly owl. A large raindrop splashed down on the paper, and the man hurriedly rolled it up and grabbed his tin box of crayons. Another handful of raindrops, and Scarlet picked up the portfolio the man pointed to, propped up beside a nearby gravestone, and followed him into the tiny porch of the church, where the rain could not touch them.
Thank you so much. I don't think it's really going to rain much. Weather forecast for this afternoon said mostly sunny.
As if in reply, the wind gusted coldly, and the rain began to beat down in earnest.
I know what you're thinking.
You do?
She had been thinking.
My mum will kill me.
You're thinking, is this a church or a funeral chapel? And the answer is, as far as I can ascertain, that on this site there was indeed a small church, and the original graveyard would have been its churchyard. That's as long ago as 800, perhaps 900 AD, rebuilt and extended several times in there. But there was a fire here in the 1820s, and by that time it was already much too small for the area. People around here were using St. Dunstan's in the village square as their parish church, so when they came to rebuild here, they made it a funeral chapel, keeping many of the original features. The stained glass windows in the far wall are said to be original.
Actually, I was thinking that my mum is going to kill me. I got the wrong bus, and I'm already so late home.
Good Lord, you poor thing. Look, I only live just down the road. You wait here.
And with that, he thrust his portfolio, his tin of crayons, and his rolled-up sheet of paper into her hands. And he set off at a trot down to the gates, his shoulders hunched against the driving rain. A couple of minutes later, Scarlet saw the lights of a car and heard the sound of a car horn. Scarlet ran down to the gates, where she could see the car, an elderly green Mini. The man she had been talking to was sitting in the driver's seat. He wound down his window.
Come on. Where exactly am I taking you?
Scarlet stood there, the rain running down her neck.
I don't take rides from strangers.
Quite right, too. But one good turn deserves, and, all that. Here. Put the stuff in the back before it gets soaked.
He pulled open the passenger door, and Scarlet leaned inside and put his grave-rubbing equipment down on the back seat as best she could.
Tell you what, why don't you phone your mother? You can use my phone and tell her my car's number plate. You can do it from inside the car. You're getting soaked out there.
Scarlet hesitated. Rain was beginning to plaster her hair down. It was cold. The man reached over and handed her his mobile phone. Scarlet looked at it. She realized she was more afraid of calling her mother than she was of getting into the car.
I could call the police too, couldn't I?
You certainly can, yes. Or you can walk home, or you can just call your mother and ask her to come and pick you up.
Scarlett got into the passenger seat and closed the door. She kept hold of the man's phone.
Where do you live?
You really don't have to. I mean, you could just take me to the bus stop.
I'll take you home. Address?
102A Acacia Avenue. It's off the main road, a wee bit past the big sports centre.
You are out of your way, aren't you? Right, let's get you home.
He took off the handbrake, swung the car around, and drove down the hill.
Been living here long?
Not really. We moved here just after Christmas. We lived here when I was 5, though.
Is that a brogue I detect in your accent?
We've been living in Scotland for 10 years. There, I sounded like everyone else. And then I came down here. And now I stick out like a sore thumb.
She had wanted it to sound like a joke, but it was true. And she could hear it as she said it. Not funny, just bitter. The man drove to Acacia Avenue, parked in front of the house, then insisted on coming up to the front door with her. When the door was opened, he said,
"Frightfully sorry. I took the liberty of bringing your daughter back to you. Obviously you taught her well, shouldn't accept rides from strangers. But, well, it was raining, she took the wrong bus, wound up on the other side of town. Bit of a mess all round, really. So you can find it in your heart to forgive. Forgive her. And, me."
Scarlett expected her mother to shout at both of them, and was surprised and relieved when her mother only said, "Well, you couldn't be too careful these days, and was Mr. A teacher, and would he like a cup of tea?" Mr. Said his name was Frost, but she could call him Jay, and Mrs. Perkins smiled and said he could call her Noona, and she'd put the kettle on. Over tea, Scarlett told her mother the story of her wrong bus adventure, and how she had found herself at the graveyard, and how she met Mr. Frost by the little church. Mrs. Perkins dropped her teacup. They were sitting around the table in the kitchen, so the cup didn't fall very far, and it didn't break, just spilled tea. Mrs. Perkins apologized awkwardly, and went and got a cloth from the sink to mop it up.
"The graveyard on the hill? In the old town? That one?"
"I live over that way. Been doing a lot of grave rubbings. And you know, it's technically a nature reserve."
"I know. Thank you so much for giving Scarlett a ride home, Mr. Frost."
Each word might have been an ice cube.
"I think you should leave now."
"I say, that's a bit much. Didn't mean to hurt your feelings. Was it something I said? The rubbings, they're for a local history project. It's not as if I'm, you know, digging up bones or anything."
For a heartbeat, Scarlett thought that her mother was going to strike Mr. Frost, who just looked worried. But Mrs. Perkins shook her head.
"Sorry. Family history, not your fault."
As if she was making a conscious effort, she said, brightly,
"You know, Scarlett actually used to play in that graveyard when she was little. This is, 10 years ago. She had an imaginary friend, too, a little boy called Nobody."
A smile twitched at the corner of Mr. Frost's lips.
"A ghosty?"
"No, I don't think so. He just lived there. She even pointed out the tomb he lived in, so I suppose he was a ghost. Do you remember, love?"
Scarlett shook her head.
"I must have been a funny kid."
"I'm sure that you are nothing of the... you are raising a fine girl here, Noona. Well, lovely cup of tea. Always a joy to make new friends. I'll be toddling off now. Got to make myself a little dinner. And I've got a meeting of the local history society."
"You're making your own dinner?"
"Yes, making it. Well, defrosting it, really. I'm also a master of the boil in the bag. Eating for one and living on my own. Bit of a crusty old bachelor. Actually, in the papers, that always means gay, doesn't it? Not gay, just never met the right woman.
And for a moment, he looked rather sad. Mrs. Perkins, who hated to cook, announced that she always cooked too much food at the weekend, and, as she ushered Mr. Frost out into the hall, Scarlet heard him agree that he would love to come round for dinner on Saturday night. When Mrs. Perkins came back from the front hall, all she said to Scarlet was,
"I hope you've done your homework."
Scarlet was thinking about the afternoon's events as she lay in bed that night, listening to the sound of the cars grinding their way along the main road. She had been there, in that graveyard, when she was little. That was why everything had seemed so familiar. In her mind, she imagined, and she remembered. And somewhere in there she fell asleep. But in sleep, she still walked the paths of the graveyard. It was night, but she could see everything as clearly as if it were day. She was on the side of a hill. There was a boy of about her own age, standing with his back to her, looking at the lights of the city.
"Boy, what are you doing?"
He looked around, seemed to have trouble focusing.
"Who said that? Oh, I can see you. Sort of. Are you dreamwalking?"
"I think I'm dreaming."
"Not quite what I meant. Hello, I'm Bud."
"I'm Scarlet."
He looked at her again, as if he were seeing her for the first time.
"Of course you are. I knew you looked familiar. You were in the graveyard today with that man, the one with the paper."
"Mr. Frost. He's really nice. He gave me a lift home. Did you see us?"
"Yeah. I keep an eye on most things that happen in the graveyard."
"What kind of a name is Bod?"
"It's short for nobody."
"Of course. That's what this dream is about. You're my imaginary friend from when I was little, all grown up."
He nodded. He was taller than she was. He wore grey, although she could not have described his clothes. His hair was too long, and she thought it had been some time since he had received a haircut.
"You were really brave. We went deep into the hill, and we saw the Indigo Man, and we met the Sleer."
Something happened then, in her head. A rushing and a tumbling, a whirl of darkness, and a crash of images.
"I remember."
But she said it to the empty darkness of her bedroom, and heard nothing in reply but the low trundle of a distant lorry making its way through the night. Bod had stores of food, the kind that lasted, cached in the crypt, and more in some of the chillier tombs and vaults and mausoleums. Silas had made sure of that. He had enough food to keep him going for a couple of months. Unless Silas or Miss Lupescu was there, he simply would not leave the graveyard. He missed the world beyond the graveyard gates, but he knew it was not safe out there. Not yet. The graveyard, though, was his world and his domain, and he was proud of it and loved it, as only a 14-year-old boy can love anything. And yet, in the graveyard, no one ever changed. The little children Bod had played with when he was small were still little children. Fortinbras Bartleby, who had once been his best friend, was now 4 or 5 years younger than Bod was, and they had less to talk about each time they saw each other. Thackeray Porringer was Bod's height and age, and seemed to be in much better temper with him. He would walk with Bod in the evenings and tell stories of unfortunate things that had happened to his friends. Normally the stories would end in the friends being hanged until they were dead for no offence of theirs and by mistake. although sometimes they were simply transported to the American colonies, and they didn't have to be hanged unless they came back. Liza Hempstock, who had been Bod's friend for the last 6 years, was different in another way.